นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะปะรุตตะเตสังมัตตสะดวาระเยโสตะวันโตปะมัจฉันตุสะดังเทวะนิพพานะ little talk this evening on the topic of enlightenment and particularlyabout the Buddhist enlightenment and the Western enlightenment. Because of course when we talk about the word enlightenment, we think of it from these days we think of it from a Buddhist point of view. Actually of course it's an English word, which has its European history and connotations and so on. When the firstgeneration of European scholars of BuddhismThis was in the late 19th century, Max Müller, Rhys Davids, Herman Oldenburg and others, first started studying the Buddhist scriptures and started considering what the nature of the Buddha's ideas were and the effect that he had, his place within Indian culture and the kinds of principles that were underlying what he was saying. They were struck with the similarity between many of the ideas they found in the Buddhist texts in the Pali Canon with values and ideas which in the European context was associated with this period called the Enlightenment. It was a historical period. And so this is why they chose to use that word Enlightenment, which for them was primarilya European historical phenomena, which they then extended to become an Eastern spiritual phenomena. Of course, it's a very, in a way, very problematic shift. They're obviously very different kinds of things. The Buddha's enlightenment is a very different kind of thing than what was meant in the West. But there were good reasons why they did that. They were trying to not just literally translate the Buddhist scriptures into the West, but they were trying to to translate the ideas, which is a much more difficult thing, yeah? To actually bring the ideas in a way which is relevant and comprehensible. So even though in the time since then, when those scholars were writing, they were writing primarily for a kind of cultured European gentleman of the colonial era. So since then, probably our historical knowledge is probably a lot less these days. Certainly our knowledge of the history of Europe is a lot less, and so we tend to not actually know very much about the European Enlightenment, and probably know more about the Buddhist Enlightenment, so that the purpose of actually using the term in the first place is probably kind of missing. And I guess that's probably reflected in the fact that many people, including myself, these days prefer to use the word awakening when we're talking about the Buddhist experience. Yeah? Awakening being more literal and in some ways more of a vibrant or immediate term. But the reason why I started thinking about this was because I was kind of following the events in the recent weeks, especially in the Arab world and the revolutions in Egypt, Tunisia, and the ongoing protests and so on in Libya and Morocco, Bahrain, and elsewhere. And it's very noteworthy that all of these revolutions, at least from all appearances, seem to be very much grassroots. And they seem to be driven by similar values that underlay the European Enlightenment. And this is one thing which has been said historically, is that the Arab world never really had an Enlightenment, and this being one of the roots of the problem with fundamentalism. So perhaps we're seeing an equivalent in the Arab world to that shift that we saw in Europe with the Enlightenment. And I mean, I'm not a scholar of that period of history, so I only have a very general, very vague historical knowledge. But and one of the catchphrases was that they used in the French Revolution was the liberty, equality, fraternity, and these were some of the values which summed up what was going on. And it was a move from kind of a patriarchal top-down system to a more of a sense of democracy, basic freedoms, and a lot of the notions that we take for granted in our Western culture these days, freedom of speech, the dignity and equal human rights for all. And so these kinds of ideas really came to a prominence in that period. And I remember my dad used to quote to me a saying from Rousseau, who was one of the great Enlightenment philosophers. He said that man is born in, free, but is everywhere in chains. So this sums up that attitude that somehow the forces of culture, of society, history, have chained up our human potential, not letting us realize what we could be. Of course, from a Buddhist point of view, you'd say it's almost exactly the opposite, isn't it? That we're not born free. Actually, we're born in chains. Yeah, so we're born from ignorance. And from a Buddhist point of view, the striking thing is not the fact that people are in chains. Really, I think the striking thing from a Buddhist point of view is that despite everything, that there is somehow in the hearts of people, there is this longing to be free. And this, I think, is a longing which is universal. And when you think about it, you think, well, actually, why is it? I don't know if there's any particularly good reason for that, why we actually want to be free. So to me, it seems like quite a surprising thing to be there in the world. One of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this, because I myself have been very, I get very inspired when I see these kind of revolutions and these movements happening. Yeah? I feel, emotionally, when I saw the peaceful revolution in Egypt, and you can see the overthrow of so much oppression and the dictatorship and so on. To me, this is a very, very marvelous thing. It's very inspiring. And to me, I feel that the same values that are coming to the fore here are actually values which, when I came to Buddhism, I recognized. They're values that I already held before I came to Buddhism, but I recognized them in Buddhism. And the reason I think it's important to point this out is because it's sometimes said, in fact, I personally find it quite regularly said to me that these are not Buddhist values. And there's many people who argue in one way or another that actually freedom, equality, and democracy are not actually Buddhist values at all. And this has been the cause of various kinds of difficulties and problems in Buddhism. For example, with the bhikkhuni ordinations we did, where from our point of view, the idea that men and women are fundamentally equal is obvious, and it's not only obvious from a secular point of view, it's obvious that that's the case in the Dhamma as well. And yet there are many people who feel that that's completely untrue. Men and women are not equal, and that there are very good reasons why women should be treated as somehow lesser than men. There's a lot of people who believe this. And they believe that that's the Buddhist idea. Or the idea of democracy. See, when we do things in the Vinaya, the way that the Buddha wanted to organize the community, it's always based on what actually the community wants. There's no idea of a top-down power structure. Everything comes from the bottom up. And so when we act in this way, then, of course, we get told this is a non-Buddhist way of thinking, that it comes from Western notions of democracy and so on, which are alien to the Buddhist way of thinking. These are the kinds of things which we've been told many, many times, not just once or twice, many, many times. So I think it's important to make this explicit and to point out that actually these values, which are, I think, inherent, there's an inherent sort of human longing for these things. These values are a very important part of Buddhism. And that the what Buddhism has to add is not to challenge or change these values, but to deepen them and to show that they actually have a profundity which goes far beyond how these things are normally expressed. So, for example, you take these three principles of liberty, equality, fraternity. Yeah. So, what does liberty mean when we come from, say, a Western secular point of view? We talk about freedom. Yeah. So, you know, freedom means, you know, certain basic freedoms like freedom of speech, freedom from freedom of movement, freedom of religion. Freedom to, you know, basically we mean that you're free to do anything that you want to do as long as it doesn't harm others. That's generally the basic principle. And we recognize when this isn't the case, that causes a lot of suffering. Yeah? So when the people who don't have freedom of speech, or when people are subject to arbitrary arrest and imprisonment and all of these kinds of things, that this is a great and unjustified suffering. But of course the problem with that is that, well, what do you do then? When you have all these freedoms, have freedom of speech, yeah? So we live in Australia, we, you know, for the most part we have reasonably good freedom of speech here. What do people actually spend most of their time talking about? Yeah? Well, you know, you can go to any number of internet chat rooms or whatever and see what people actually talk about. And, of course, the reality is that having been granted that freedom, we don't necessarily use it very wisely, yeah? And so those values, those social values from the Enlightenment, they don't take us very far. They give us certain basic conditions that can help. But then what we do with that is really up to us. And similarly with the notion of equality. You know, again, equality as a principle doesn't mean that everybody's literally equal. And this is how the thing is sometimes parodied. You know, it's criticized as if when you talk about equality that you're saying that everyone's equal. Well, obviously people are not equal. Obviously some people are bigger and some people are smaller. Some people are old and some people are young. Some people are tall, some people are short. And whatever. Yeah? But the point is that none of these differences are actually that important. Right? And especially they're not important ethically. They might be significant in some contexts. Right, and you take account of people's differences in certain contexts. Fair enough, but they don't fundamentally affect who we are as human beings. Yeah, they're just contingent things. So this notion of equality doesn't mean equality in fact. It means an ethical equality. It means an equality of principle, that people get treated with equal dignity. But again, you know, once you kind of establish that equality in society. Of course, what do you choose to do with that? You know, say in Australia we've given everybody the vote. Yeah? So everyone, you know, in a sense has an equal say if they want to in political process. Or we have an equality in various kinds of human rights and so on and so forth. But the question then is, well, what do we do with that? Yeah? What do we do when we have that possibility to act? Yeah? So, you know, again, to compare it with that situation, if you're in, say, a dictatorship like Egypt was, possibly still is, the army's still in control there, but where people don't have a voice in the say of their government. Yeah. So we come to Australia where people do have a voice. Yeah. What do they do with that voice? Yeah. Well, the reality, of course, is that most of the time we don't do very much. Yeah. And most of the time we maybe show up. Well, in Australia we have to show up at the polls, otherwise we get fined. But apart from that, well, we have our equality, but we more or less often take it for granted. Yeah? We don't actually use it very much. And similarly, this notion of fraternity from a social or secular sense is a somewhat kind of limited idea, although it is quite a powerful idea. And the idea of fraternity, I think, is actually an important one to consider, because it reflects on the level of maturity of a people. Now, if you think about it by comparing with personal growth and personal development of a person during their life, when we're young, when we're children, we're growing up, we're orientated very much towards our parents, yeah? And so it's our parents who make decisions. They decide, they do, we follow, yeah? And so it's a very kind of a paternalistic or patriarchal structure. So when that value of fraternity is being introduced, what it's saying is that we no longer want to live in that kind of relationship where we are regarded as something, we're just told what to do by somebody who assumes that they know everything. But we want to live in a fraternal relationship. That means a relationship among equals, yeah, brothers and sisters. So we see each other as brothers and sisters rather than an authority figure who tells everyone what to do. And of course, that's what happens when we grow up, isn't it? Yeah? As we grow up, we more and more move into a situation where actually our primary relationships are with, say, brothers and sisters or with people of our own age and so on. And that we work together, relate together, and able to make decisions together rather than being subject to decisions from above. So that notion of fraternity is actually a very profound one. And it points to an actual direction, this shift. And I think this is a very important point, and one which is very, I think it's controversial, but I think it's important. And again, when we've been in these dialogues, it sometimes gets said that Asian people are one way and Western people are the other way, as if these things are completely culturally arbitrary. I don't believe that at all. I believe that they actually relate to important aspects of human development, and that there's an actual direction and an arrow in it. I think it's actually more mature and better to be in a fraternal relationship than in a paternalistic one. When I say better, I don't mean better in an absolute sense. I mean, obviously, if you're a child, well, obviously you need to be in a paternalistic relationship. But for adults, that's actually how we should be. Yeah? And to try to force this paternalistic structure on adults, I think is wrong, and I think is limiting. So these kind of values, which are good values from the Enlightenment, but from a Buddhist point of view, each of these is taken to a much deeper level. And so the value of freedom, for example, yeah, Buddhism is freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah, it's a much more profound notion of freedom, isn't it? Yeah? Being free to say what you want, or free to choose your religion, or whatever it is, you know, that's anybody can do that. Yeah, pretty much. But to be completely free from all of these emotions and forces in your mind which bring suffering, to be free from all intentions to harm, to be free from all delusion in your life, that's something which is very, very profound and very rare, very hard. In fact, it's so hard, it's almost like it's almost mythic. It's almost like this just this imaginary ideal that we aspire to. And so it actually gives us an orientation and a direction. It's not just something where you can say, open up the prisons and say, okay, well, now do what you want, and we haven't got anything more to say to you. But it's something which can actually orientate your whole life. And you say, well, this is something that's really worth doing, because I recognize that when I have greed and hatred and delusion in my heart, that I act in ways that cause suffering for myself and I cause suffering for others. And so every time I see that greed, hatred, and delusion there, I have the choice to try to overcome that, or alternatively, to go under its sway and to reinforce it. And each time that we manage to overcome it just a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, we see the benefits of that, and we get more of a glimpse and a deeper meaning of what that direction and that goal in life is. So that freedom, from a Buddhist point of view, is far deeper and far more meaningful than the freedom from just a secular point of view. It's the same basic value, but it's taken to a great, much deeper degree. And similarly, the idea of equality. You know, you think everyone's kind of equal. Because in fact, reality is that we go around judging people all the time, don't we? Yeah? You walk down the street and immediately you see people walking down and your mind's constantly making judgment, yeah? old, fat, beautiful, ugly, rich, poor, thin, sick, healthy, whatever. And your mind's constantly making these judgments about people when we see them. Yeah, you can't help it. So we're constantly like creating these hierarchies and structures and dividing people in our mind as much as we'd like to treat them actually equally. And so with Buddhism and through the practice of meditation, you actually learn to drop that habit of the mind. And so people actually become equal. There's a word in Pali, savatatized, to each as to oneself, yeah? So the practice of metta. And not equal in the sense of being, yes, you consider each person of equal value, but equal in the sense that the very possibility of discriminating, the very possibility of treating one person as of more value or worth than another, just isn't there anymore. Yeah? It's just gone. It doesn't mean that you can't, again, it doesn't mean you can't discriminate in terms of just, you know, differentiating between people. Yeah, of course you can still differentiate. You still know that this person is more intelligent than this person. You still know that this person has these skills and that person doesn't, right? It doesn't mean that you become stupid, but it means that link between recognizing that people have different qualities and actually judging them and judging their worth by that quality, that link is completely severed. Yeah? So that's, again, that notion of equality is happening on a far more profound level. And also the idea, that also binds in with the idea of fraternity. Yeah? So it's so that from a Buddhist point of view, the idea of fraternity is extended to a much greater degree. And again, this is something which I think is not just, it's not just cultural, it's not just bound to a specific time and place, but it's inherent in the development of our minds, the development of our consciousness, of our emotions. When we grow up, initially we're just attached to ourselves, you know, concerned with ourselves. We gradually learn to extend that to our family. Gradually we learn to extend it past the family, maybe to friends. Yeah? There's a kind of a slow, and then from the friends we get a perception maybe of a tribe or of a local area. We manage to develop maybe a perception of a nation, or it might be of a race, or it might be whatever. So that our notion of ourself, the notion of the sphere of our concern, gradually becomes extended as we grow up. But it usually remains limited to some degree. And these values all exist at the same time. Yeah, it's not that one replaces another. So you still have the fundamental concern with yourself. You still have the concern for the family, and concern at these different levels. These all coexist. But again, from a Buddhist point of view, all of that gets turned completely upside down, so that your primary identification, sabbe sattā bhavantu sukhinātā, may all beings be happy, is with all beings. Yeah? Forget about race, forget about nation, religion, gender, even species. Yeah? Aliens are all fine. Yeah? Worms, whatever, doesn't matter. Being visible or invisible. Yeah, so any being that feels suffering and that knows what suffering and happiness is, that's our sphere of concern, and that's where that's what we feel ourselves a part of. Yeah? So this, and that's our fraternity. So again, that notion is it's a similar idea. It's not phrased in exactly the same way, but it's a similar idea, and it's taken to a far more profound level. So this is why I look with rejoicing and support when I see these movements for which I think are trying to express these values in society. I don't think these things are at all problematic or contradictory to Buddhism. On the contrary, I think that they are little steps that a society that can take that will embody some fundamental principles which are at the heart of the Dhamma. And because there's always a connection between what happens in the wider society and what happens in individuals, these things always influencing each other. Not necessarily, whether in a good way or a bad way, not necessarily in obvious ways, but they're always affecting each other. And so my hope is that when these values are actually found and actually present in society, that they can help to nurture and to improve and to give the context where we can develop those Buddhist values to an even more profound degree. Of course, there's a big difference between having a value and the reality in society. Yeah? So if you look at Australian society, it's a very obvious example where we like to say that we're very egalitarian and we value equality and these kinds of things, and to some degree that's true, but it's also true that there's a lot of inequality in Australia and that people are not actually treated as equals. And of course we know that so many examples of this being the case. So there's a big gap between the reality and the values. But the values still give us something to aspire to. It doesn't mean the values are wrong. It just means that we've still got work to do. Yeah? It means that we can't, that it's not time to just relax and stop working just yet. But we've still got work to do. So I would like to see these as part of our practice of Buddhism, is to recognize that these things are Buddhist values and that trying to work in society to support these values is also part of our Dhamma practice, and that in addition to helping bring about these positive changes in society and to support them, that they will also manifest inwardly by helping us to develop these things to a deeper degree in our own mind, our own consciousness. So this is just a little talk for you this evening on liberty, equality and fraternity.